And welcome everybody to this sutta class on it's the new year day today, so chosen for this is for the Sri Lankan, Thai, Burmese, Laotian, Cambodian new year day, so we've been very busy this morning, so I've chosen a short sutta today, but a very beautiful sutta, and it's a sutta where we see what is called a non-returner become fully enlightened. And it has some other interesting aspects of the Dhamma which will come apparent once the sutta is read. So have you all got copies? Has anyone not got a copy of the sutta? Is there any left over there, Lynn? If you can share, be good. Oh, still hasn't got one. See if you can share one with somebody. Go and sit next to somebody so you can share it. Is there anyone? This fellow over here, the young man. She's sharing over here with. It's okay, he's sharing with Winston. It's fine. Or with somebody anyway. Okay, can you share? Okay. So we can share. If you've got your big book, which is amazing, you bought the big book, it's in the Khanda Sanyutta, number 87. Khanda, it's linked to number 22, the 22nd Sanyutta, Khanda Sanyutta, Sutta number 87. Khanda Sanyutta, Kemaka. He's in there somewhere. Khema. Kemaka. Okay. Yes, behind you. Very good. Okay. So let's get going. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato Arahato sammasambuddhassa Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this is from the Connected Discourses, otherwise known as Sanghita Nikaya, one of the really big chapters on the aggregates or the khandhas, in Sanskrit the skandhas. And this is the one about Venerable Kemaka. He was a monk, and this is what happened to him. So on one occasion, a number of elder bhikkhus were dwelling at Kosambi in Gocitas Park. And if I'm not mistaken, that's where modern-day Allahabad is. And unfortunately, the city has grown up so much that where the monastery would have stood is now a big not housing complex, but part of the city of Allahabad. Now, on that occasion, Venerable Kemaka was living at Jujube Tree Park, sick, afflicted, gravely ill. So every little area would have many places where the community of monks would stay, maybe several little monasteries or small hermitages surrounding each little major center for Buddhists. Then in the evening, those elder bhikkhus emerged from seclusion and addressed the Venerable Dasaka thus. It was the custom, even in the time of the Buddha, for the Sangha, the monks and the nuns, to spend most of the day by themselves as little hermits, each in their own either huts or in the forests. Often they would go into the jungles just to find some solitude. And then they come back to the main areas in the evening And this is where they came and they asked a monk called Dasaka, "Come, friend Dasaka, approach the bhikkhu Kaimaka and say to him, 'The elders say to you, friend Kaimaka, we hope that you are bearing up, friend. We are hope that you are getting better. We are hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is to be discerned.'" And that is usually the standard way that monks would ask another monk how you're going. In other words, it won't say, "How are you feeling today?" So anyone who's a doctor who works in the hospitals, when you see your patient, Dr. Mukta, you should be a Buddhist and ask them, "Dear patient, we hope you are bearing up. We hope that you are getting better. We hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and they're subsiding, not the increase, is to be discerned." Is that how you talk to your patients in hospital? But that's how they used to do it in the time of the Buddha. "Yes, friends," the Venerable Dasaka replied. And he approached the Venerable Kaimaka and delivered the message. So instead of going to see the Venerable Kaimaka yourself, he said, "You go for us." And interestingly, Dasaka, it actually means, Dasaka is actually the word, Adasa is a word for a slave, or a servant. So it's interesting, the whole name there, you know, means actually Venerable Slave. That'd be a good name for the next monk I ordain, don't you think? Venerable Dasa. Then Venerable Kaimaka, so he delivered his message. Then Venerable Kaimaka answered, "I am not bearing up, friend. I am not getting better. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding. And their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned." So monks, you know, would always tell the truth. Nuns always have to tell the truth. So if you go and see them and say, "How are you feeling today?" you can expect them to sometimes say, "Terrible, awful." But you're not supposed to do that as a layperson, are you? If someone comes to me and says, well, I'm feeling a little bit better today," to try and cheer people up. But be careful. If you ask a monk, and if they really are sick, they say, "Well, I'm sick. It's getting worse." They're honest for a change. I mean, they're always honest, but they, for a change. You know what I mean anyway. I hope. So he said, "Then the Venerable Dasaka approached the elder bhikkhus and reported what the Venerable Kaimaka had said." So he went all the way back to the elders, and the elders told him, "Come, friend Dasaka, approach the bhikkhu Kaimaka again and say to him, 'The elders say to you, friend Kaimaka, these five aggregates subject to clinging, friend, have been spoken of by the Blessed One. That is, the form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging, and the consciousnesses aggregate subject to clinging. Does the Venerable Kaimaka regard anything as self or as belonging to self among these five aggregates subject to clinging?'" Now, first of all, the five aggregates is a very common scheme of describing, especially the human being, in terms of five different parts. Now, those five different parts are sometimes overlapping. Sometimes it's just a way of looking at this thing we call, in just maybe two sections, body and mind, in a way which we can analyze and see a bit more clearly what we're talking about by a person. The form aggregate is basically your body, you know, your skin, your lungs, and everything else which is you, your physical body. In a more general sense, it's every stuff, you know, the air, the earth, the stars. Anything which is like stuff comes under the form aggregate. And then we have the feeling aggregate, and we don't have a suitable word in English for this part of the human experience, because the words we have for feeling differ from each one of the senses. what feeling is that aspect of sensory experience which is either gives you the sense of pleasure, in between, or unpleasant. So that means that if it's like with seeing, we have a different word for the pleasurable feelings for seeing than from the pleasurable feelings from hearing. We say it's beautiful, it's attractive. That's the pleasant feeling associated with seeing. But if it's with, say, hearing something, we never say it's a beautiful sound, or sometimes we do, but mostly say it's, you know, it's a very, was it pleasing sound, a very harmonious sound, a very sonorous sound. Whatever is the sense of beauty, pleasure, goodness, giving you some happiness, that is the pleasurable feeling associated with every one of the six senses. And the unpleasant feeling, again, has a different name. It's ugly, if it's a really harsh sound, or it's a bitter taste, or a painful feeling in the body. Those feelings, they've got the painful, the negative, the suffering feeling, it's also got a different name. So that is what we mean by feeling in this canvas. That aspect of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or knowing, which is pleasurable, attractive, nice, and which is, you know, abhorrent, suffering, painful, is the negative feeling. And we also have in between as well. That is this thing we call feeling, an aspect of sensory experience. And of course, you cannot have sensory experience without one of those three feelings. In general, looking for a good word, not absolutely accurate, but as close as we can get, pleasant feeling, sort of neutral feeling, and unpleasant feeling, the three feelings associated with every one of the senses. And then we have perception, is the third of the khandhas, or the aggregates. And perception, again, is the aspect of sensory experience, where literally we give things a name, we understand it, that's the boy, that's the girl, that is green, that is yellow, that is hot, that is cold. And I think when I explain things like perception, this is hot, this is cold, it really sort of, it's not an absolute, but there's a lot of subjective views behind your perceptions. If you are, if you've just come from, say, Darwin, this is probably cold today. If you just come from, say, UK, this is probably really hot today. So even like the perceptions we can see are not absolute realities, but it's just the interpretations which we have on our reality. And everything which is perception, giving it a colour, giving it a name, that is what the candle of perception is. It's an inevitable part of sensory experience. I say inevitable because when you have a sensory experience, you have to perceive it in one way or another. And the next of the khandhas is sometimes called formations. In this particular translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, he calls it volitional formations. And this is, again, the part of the mental world which also includes things like thoughts. It includes, you know, the emotions, the other word which we usually give the feelings to. The word feelings to emotions such as sadness, anger, grief, fear. That is also part of this big section called formations, sankharas. And here that he has translated it as volitional formations. And that is the reason for that is the Buddha in other places once said the most important part of this fourth khandha, this fourth part of this framework, is volition, is will, is chetana. And that's why he called it volitional formations in this translation. So one of the most important parts of this fourth khandha is, again, volition, will, choice. And again, that has to be there somewhere. And lastly, the consciousnesses aggregate, that's the six. And when I talk about consciousnesses, it's sometimes that word is so overused in the English language, sometimes we need to describe it with a bit more accuracy. It is more like, you know, the screen of a TV. And, you know, all this other stuff is what appears on the screen of the TV. But, you know, you can't have, you know, the images on the TV without the screen. So this is like the six different types of screen, the six different types of consciousnesses, you know, on which the mental and physical phenomena are discerned. So consciousnesses, the six consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, the five external ones, and the mind is the sixth consciousness. Six different types of consciousnesses. And it's part of the job, the task of meditation, to actually to see, you know, what these different types of consciousnesses appear to have in common and just how different they are. So those are a way of dealing with these thing called the body and mind, our reality, the person. And where it says here, the conscious aggregate subject to clinging, the thing where it says the subject to clinging is explained in the Mahavedala Sutta, where somebody asks, you know, are these five aggregates and the five aggregates subject to clinging, are they the same, are they different? What does it mean, the subject to clinging business? And there it was answered, the standard answer. It's really just the five aggregates, they're the same. All it's doing when it's mentioning subject to clinging, it means they have come up, you know, because of attachments in the past. That's why you have the five aggregates in this life. And if you don't watch out, they can be the fuel which gives rise to more aggregates in your next life. So they're just talking about these. When it says subject to clinging, instead of using the word clinging, another alternative for that Pali word is fuel. Like, you know, the gas in the car, the electricity in the power lines, the fuel which keeps things running. And so that where the Buddha is mentioning this subject to clinging business, all he's doing is mentioning that these five aggregates, the five khandhas, you know, they have been fueled from what you've been doing in the previous life, and they are the fuel which keeps you going on into another life. But basically, he said, you can just call them the five aggregates, and don't put any other meaning in subject to clinging. So those are the five aggregates. And the monks are asking the elder Kaimukha, do you regard anything as a self or as belonging to a self among these five aggregates subject to clinging? And that gives you the indication why it is that the Buddha actually chose these five particular categories of experience and no other categories of experience. And the answer is not said anywhere in the suttas, but it is inferred that these are five places where people assume they exist. They usually put the hat of their self. They either think that they are the body, they are the feelings, they are the perceptions, that they are the volition or the thoughts, they are the consciousness. That's what we usually think we are. And so by the Buddha separating this experience of being a human being into these five categories, these were the five categories where most people would assume they exist. So even today, even though many, many, many people just have seen on TV or seen in real life what's inside the human body, but still we still associate this thing called our body as being ourself. So much so that when we get close to death, we're afraid of losing this body. I don't know why. Because if you thought this body was the same as your car, yeah, you know, if your car gets lost or gets stolen or breaks down, yeah, it's a disappointment, it's an inconvenience, but you don't go crying, oh, I've crashed my car, and you know, have to have grief counselling because you've lost your car. But that's really just what our body is, you know, it's just like a vehicle. And so, you know, when somebody loses their vehicle or you lose your own vehicle, there's no reason to sort of go crying and becoming grief-stricken. But you can see that people don't regard the body has nothing to do with them. They regard it as a self, that this is your most personal possession. And this is why that Buddha said, look at this, this is not yours. It's not who you are. And if you could focus on that, you won't be scared of death anymore, nor will you have all this grief when somebody dies. You won't have to waste all this money on all these ceremonies when somebody dies. I've said this before and I'll say it again, and this is online. When I die, I don't want a big funeral. When I die, I want to go in the yellow recycling bins. And you're taken off to be recycled somewhere. And that's it. No ceremony. No funeral directors. Okay? Please keep my dying wish. It might be illegal. Never mind. It's only your body, for goodness sake. And the second thing, your feelings. We always think that that is so personal to us. You know, the happiness. So when you're really sad and depressed, oh, I'm not feeling my real self today. When I'm happy and jolly, oh, that's the real me. You can't have just happiness without a bit of suffering. Nor can you have suffering without happiness. So when you understand what this feeling business is, you'll understand that all happiness through any of the six senses, through any one of them, all happiness is the space between two moments of suffering. And suffering is only a space between two moments of happiness. Just like day is only a space between two nights, and a night is only a pause between two daytimes. You cannot have one without the other. So when you know that, it can't be yours. It's not you, but also it can't be yours. If it was yours, you'd be able to control it. And that's a great myth of human beings. Always thinking, if I become a bit wiser, if I come to the Buddhist center and learn all this incredible Dhamma, then I won't have any suffering anymore. I'll just have happiness. Woohoo! If that's how you think, you can get very disappointed. Because doesn't matter how long you come here, you'll still have suffering from time to time. Because you'll start to know that all suffering is the gap between two moments of happiness. All happiness is space between two moments of suffering. You can't have one without the other. You can't have night without day. You can't have cold without hot. You can't have tea without condensed milk. No, I shouldn't say that. That's a totally different metaphor. So sorry, I should have said that. Probably in a silly mood. So this is when you know it's not me, but it's not mine also. I can't control it. And you have perceptions. And this thing about perception, just the way you think about life, what you see. It's just like, you know, the food which you like and the food which you don't like. That's all to do with perceptions. And again, that's not you. That's just totally, totally conditioned. But the next one, the next two are the places where most people have their understanding that where they exist. They think they are the will. And they even think they're the thoughts as well. Those two are right in there with the feeling aggregate, the fourth kanda. And it's very obvious that you think you are your thoughts. I just had a good thought. This is my thought. And I think I mentioned a week or two ago that sometimes we get pulled into our thoughts, just like we get pulled into a movie. And we really think we're right there inside the screen, so much so that we cry when something bad happens. We feel scared when some scary thing happens. It's like, you know, we are in the movie, instead of realizing that this is just movie on a screen. Why are we affected at all? And that's the same with our thoughts. It's one of the reasons why we think too much, because we get involved. We think that I am right in those thoughts. But mostly, we assume that we are the source of the will. That I make the choices, that I decide what I'm going to do. And I've given many talks in that, scary talks, to say you are not in control. You are subject to conditioning, to brainwashing. And lastly, it's consciousnesses. Yeah, we may not believe that we are the will, but at least we think that we are the one listening to Ajahn Brahm today. That we are the one who is feeling the pain in the body. That we are the consciousness. So these are all delusions. And these are the five places where we can think we exist. Or we think we own these things, that this is my consciousness to control. So, That is why the Buddha taught these five khandhas, especially to understand and penetrate the truth of there's nobody in here, there is no self. Yeah. Memory is a great sort of thing to understand. There's two types of memory. And the first memory is, you know, you've heard me say this before, is very similar to the game of Chinese whispers. You don't remember what happened, say, a year ago. You remember the last time you remembered it. And the last time you remembered it was the memory of the previous time you remembered it. So the memory becomes like this game of Chinese whispers. I don't know why they called it Chinese whispers. It has nothing to do with the Chinese culture at all. But in the West, I remember as a school kid, we'd all line up in a line, and the teacher would whisper something to the first kid, and the kid would whisper something to the next, and the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. When it got to the end, it was totally different than what the teacher said. Because every time it was heard, it was slightly misheard. And then repeated another little mistake. By the time it got to the end, it was totally different. Now that is the way that most memory works. Which is why that what you remembered happened and what Ronnie, your wife, remembered happened are usually so different, you have big arguments. And when you understand what memory actually is, stop arguing. No one knows what happens. And say, I'm absolutely sure that this happened. And she said, no. That didn't happen. I'm sure it happened. Now that type of memory causes arguments. And that's why it cannot be trusted. Now the other type of memory is actually much more interesting. That is what is actually stored in the mind. And that it can be accessed almost like without anything going in between. And that, you know, you usually get that type of memory through either hypnosis, regression, or through meditation. And that type of that memory is usually accurate. And that type of memory is not affected by things like Alzheimer's and dementia, by diseases of the brain. Now that's the sort of memory which I'm always much more interested in. The memory which you can get from deep meditation or from hypnosis, where you're accessing the mind rather than the brain. Two different types of memory. And that first memory, you know, it only goes back to maybe just four or three years of age or something, when your brain was starting to form. The other memory goes back into your womb and into past lives and everything. That's why I'm always interested in that second part of memory, which is much more accurate and also goes back much further. But where it would actually be put, usually, interestingly, it would be covering the third khanda, perception, and also the fourth khanda, thoughts. So memory would probably be straddling those two. Did that answer the question? Okay, very good. Okay. Split. That's a very good question. I would think the ordinary memory would be more in the third khanda, the first type of memory, more like perception. And the second type of memory would be much more in the fourth khanda. But they still straddle. Just like even feeling, you know, the second khanda and the third khanda, feeling and perception. Those two just, you know, they're not such distinct categories. They just have a big overlap as well. Because I perceive this as pleasurable. Because everyone else tells me it is. So the perception and the feeling also just, they merge into each other. Other question was, of those two types of memories which I talked about, you know, the ordinary memory, what most people call memory, which is, you know, the Chinese whispers, and the memory which you can access in meditation or in hypnosis. And those two types of memory, you know, do they belong in the same khanda? So whenever you make any classification, it's always very arbitrary. as you know, you all know when there is a line drawn between sort of Bangladesh and India. You know, why is this the line here? And just on this side is Bangladesh and this side is India, or this is Burma and this is Thailand, where, you know, people on either side, you know, they've grown up together, they speak the same language, have the same culture. So whenever we have classifications like this, the borders, you know, between sort of perception and volitional formations, or between feelings and perceptions, it's not sort of, you know, a cut and dried sort of different area. There is a lot of overlap. Yes? The second part of memory is volitional formations. It would usually be most of it, I would stick it in there, in that part of it. These are all types of concepts. In other words, they are formed, they are created, in that sense, that's a sankhara. It's hard to put it just in one particular category, because it overlaps several categories when we talk about memory. But we put about in these each one of these things, because a lot of times when you have a memory, it is manifested either as perception or as a thought. And if it's more manifested as a thought, then it belongs fair and square in the fourth kanda. Volitional formations, that one includes thoughts. If it's more like the way you perceive things, then it's more in the third kanda of perceptions. Okay, but the main point is, does the Venerable Kaimukha regard anything as self or belonging to self among those five aggregates? It also needs to be said that when you talk about these five aggregates, they do actually contain everything. It's very hard to try and conceive of anything which is outside of these five khandhas. If it is outside of these five khandhas, it must be unconscious. It must have no will involved in it. It can have no perceptions. It can have no pleasure, no pain, no in-between. And, you know, no stuff. It's easy to understand non-stuff. But when there's no consciousness of any form, when there is no happiness, no sadness, no in-between, nothing at all, it means actually you're not perceiving, you're not sentient at all. And there's no consciousness there. So if you conceive of or try and think of something beyond these five khandhas, it has to be some unconscious entity with no experience to it. So, yes, friend, the Venerable Daska replied, and he approached the Venerable Kaimukha and delivered the message. So this is the second time he's gone to Venerable Kaimukha. And then the Venerable Kaimukha replied, these five aggregates subject to clinging have been spoken of by the Blessed One, and he goes through them again. It's always repetition here. The form aggregate of feeling, perception, volitional formations and consciousnesses. Among these five aggregates subject to clinging, I do not regard anything as the self or as belonging to self. Then the Venerable Dasaka approached the elder bhikkhus and took the reply back and reported what the Venerable Kaimukha had said. And they replied, come, friend Dasaka, approach the bhikkhu Kaimukha. This is number three. And say to him, the elder state of Venerable Kaimukha, these five aggregates subject to clinging have been spoken of by the Blessed One, that is, form, feeling, perception, volitional formations and consciousnesses subject to clinging. If the Venerable One does not regard anything among these five aggregates subject to clinging as self or as belonging to self, then he is an arahat, one whose taints or outflowings are destroyed. Yes, friend, Venerable Dasaka replied, and so he went back to see Venerable Kaimukha and delivered the message. And Kaimukha said, these five aggregates subject to clinging have been spoken of by the Blessed One, that is the form aggregate, feeling, perception, volitional formations and consciousnesses. I do not regard anything among these five aggregates subject to clinging as self or as belonging to self. Yet I am not an arahat, one whose taints are destroyed. Friends, the notion I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five aggregates subject to clinging, but I don't regard any of them as this I am. So he's saying that, you know, he doesn't regard, view any of these things as him or belonging to him, yet he still has this thought or feeling of I am. So then the Venerable Dasaka approached the elder bhikkhus and reported what the Venerable Kamaka had said. And they replied, "Come, friend Dasaka, approach the bhikkhu Kamaka." This is time number four. "And say to him, 'The elders say to you, friend Kamaka, when you speak of this I am, what is it that you speak of as I am? Do you speak as form as I am? Or do you speak of I am apart from form? Do you speak of feeling as I am, or do you speak of I am apart from feeling? Do you speak of perception as I am, or do you speak as I am apart from perception? Do you speak of volitional formations as I am, or do you speak of I am apart from volitional formations? Do you speak of consciousness is as I am, or do you speak of I am apart from consciousnesses? When you speak of this I am, friend Kamaka, what is it that you speak of as I am?" "Yes, friend." And the Venerable Dasaka replied, and he approached the Venerable Kamaka for the fourth time. I'm only eight, saying the fourth time. And what did Kamaka said? "Enough, friend Dasaka. Why keep running back and forth?" You'd think these elder monks would just go and visit him instead of sending these messages back and forth. Talk of shuttle diplomacy. So anyway, so poor Venerable Kamaka, who was sick, remember, afflicted, where the unpleasant feelings were increasing and not decreasing, he had to get his staff and go by himself. "Enough, friend Dasaka, why keep running back and forth? Bring me my staff, friend. I'll go to the elder bhikkhus myself." Then a Venerable Kamaka, leaning on his staff, approached the elder bhikkhus, exchanged greetings with them, and sat down to one side. And yet, the elder bhikkhus then could speak to him straight into his face. "Friend Kamaka, when you speak of this I am, what is it that you speak of as I am?" "Friends, I do not speak of form, my body, as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from my body. I do not speak of feeling as I am, nor do I speak of feeling as apart. Nor do I speak of I am apart from feeling. I do not speak of perception as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from perceptions. I do not speak of volitional formations as I am, nor as I am apart from volitional formations. I do not speak of consciousness as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from consciousness. Friend, although the notion I am has not yet vanished in me in relation to these five aggregates subject to clinging, still I do not regard anything among them as this I am." Now to explain this is the reason I give this sutta, why it's a very famous sutta. He gives these very beautiful similes. "Suppose, friends, there is the scent of a blue, red or white lotus. Would one be speaking rightly if one would say the scent belongs to the petals, the scent belongs to the stalk, the scent belongs to the pistils? No, friend. And how, friend, should one answer if one is to answer rightly? Answering rightly, friend, one should answer the scent belongs to the flower. So too, friends, I do not speak of form as I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from form. I do not speak of feeling as I am, or I am apart from feeling. I do not speak of perception as I am, or I am apart from perception. I do not speak of volitional formations as I am, or I am apart from things like will and thought. I do not speak of consciousness I am, nor do I speak of I am apart from consciousnesses. Friend, although the notion I am has not yet vanished in me, in relation to these five aggregate subjects of clinging, still I do not regard them as I am." So he still, even though he knows there's nothing in there, still they have the scent of the flower left, the scent of I am still left. It's just the same as this morning in the ceremony for the new year. We spent an hour and a half in the community hall as monks, having our hands washed with scented water. Yes, there is still the scent of ladies' perfume on my hands, because they put all sorts of stuff in this water when they wash your hands. The scent still remains, even though the water has long gone. So this is the scent of I am still remains. And even my cave, where I live in Serpentine, it is now one of the tourist attractions of Serpentine. When people go to the monastery, they always want to have a look inside my cave. And no, I know when a person's been in there, because lay people, they leave a different scent. And I know, I can smell it in there when somebody's been in there and they've gone. So even though people have gone, we each have our own little scent which we leave behind. The dogs know this very well, even though we've left. So this is sometimes what the scent of I am is still there, even though he knows none of these things is belonging to me. And this is one of the most beautiful descriptions of the difference between what in Buddhism we call the stream winner. The stream winner, the soul one, knows fully that none of these things can be me or belonging to me. But the anagami, he's got so far, or she's got so far, but still they've got the last little sense of I am left. There's another wonderful simile in a moment. Friends, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five lower fetters, still in relation to the five aggregates subject to clinging, there lingers in them a residual conceit, I am, a desire, I am, an underlying tendency, I am, that has not yet been uprooted. Sometimes later he dwells contemplating, this is a bad translation, the rise and fall, the cause of these aggregates coming into existence, and the fact that they will cease again. Such is form, such is its origin, such is its passing away. This is what it means by rise and fall, seeing the origin of these things, seeing that when the causes for these things disappear, then they also disappear. Such is feeling, such is perception, such is volitional formation, such is will. This is where will comes from. This is where will vanishes, seeing its causes. This means it's not you. Seeing consciousnesses come into existence and seeing consciousnesses pass away. And remember, I always call it consciousnesses. It's not one thing. There's six consciousnesses, totally different animals. You see, when one comes up, the other ones aren't there. And then that means, you know, which one is the real you? And none of them can be the real you. They're totally different consciousnesses. And seeing them, where they come from and how they pass away, when you dwell doing that, as he dwells thus, contemplating the origin and passing away of the five aggregates subject to clinging, then the residual conceit, I am, the desire, I am, the underlying tendency, I am, that had not yet been uprooted, this comes to be uprooted. Suppose, friends, a cloth had become soiled and stained, and its owners give it to a laundry man. And the laundry man, you see, in those times, it wasn't laundry women. Men used to do the laundry in those days, so it's traditional as a Buddhist for the men to do the laundry. That's what it says here, laundry man. So you girls who are married to a Buddhist man, say, look, it says here, you should do the laundry. Okay, I don't think I'll get away with that, but I tried. So the laundry man would scour it evenly with cleaning salt, lye, or cow dung. Now that is always that interests me when I first read in the time of the Buddha, you know, in India, they would wash things with cow dung. And, you know, I don't think anyone would do that these days. That's why I don't give the laundry to a man. Do it yourself. You might wash it in the old Buddhist way. Because cow dung was considered to be fragrant in those days. And there's all these stories that these people would invite the monks with the Buddha to come to a dana at their house. You know, like some of you invited me to your house, you know, to offer food. But before the monks would come, they'd smear the walls and the floor with cow dung. Now, if you did that, I wouldn't go. Sorry. But in the time of the Buddha, that was considered to be, you know, really sort of decorating the place and making it look good. So you can see just how, you know, customs and perceptions change. So they actually, they would use cow dung to wash clothes with in India. And then rinse it in clean water. Even though that cloth would become pure and clean, it would still retain a residual smell of cleaning salt, lye, or cow dung that had not yet vanished. The laundry man would then give it back to the owners, and the owners would put it in a sweet-scented casket, and the residual smell of cleaning salt, lye, or cow dung that had not yet vanished would vanish. As I say, when, you know, when you wash your clothes with some of these detergents, afterwards they have the smell of the detergent. You know, but after a while it just vanishes and disappears. So this is actually how this I am, this residual I am, still can linger for a while, even though you know there's nothing there. The simile which I try to think up was, say, the person who was like a smoker of cigarettes. Hopefully none of you are like that nowadays, but you may have done that in the past. And you know smoking is bad for your health. You have no doubts it's killing you, but still, you can't give it up yet. And then when you do give it up, still that lingering desire for wanting to smoke still lingers there. It's just like, you know, the smell of the cow dung hasn't actually totally eradicated yet. Until after a long while, then, you know, even the desire to have a cigarette doesn't even come up. So these are lingering sort of underlying tendencies. It takes a while before they totally disappear. So too, friends, even though a noble disciple has abandoned even the five lower fetters, still in relation to the five aggregates subject to clinging, there lingers in them a residual conceit, the thought of I am, the desire I am, an underlying tendency I am, that has not yet been fully uprooted. And but when he dwells contemplating the origin and passing away, the rise and fall in the five aggregates, the residual conceit I am, the desire I am, the underlying tendency I am that has not yet been uprooted, then it comes to be uprooted. By the rise and fall, the origin and passing away, you just keep reinforcing the message that, you know, these things cannot be me. I cannot call this an I. I cannot say I am my body when I see just where the body comes from, where it will go to. I cannot say these feelings are mine when I see just, you know, how they come up and where they go to, how they disappear. I cannot even perception say that, you know, this is me. When you see how a perception arises and how when the causes are taken away, the perception vanishes. When you see where the will comes from, where all your choices come from, and if that influence is taken away, you don't have that will anymore, that choice anymore. And how these consciousnesses arise, the six ones playing around together, and why they disappear. By contemplating their causes and their passings away, then the residual tendency of I am is uprooted. When this was said, the elder bhikkhu said to the Venerable Kamaka, "We did not ask our questions in order to trouble the Venerable Kamaka, but we thought that the Venerable Kamaka would be capable of explaining, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, disclosing, analyzing, and elucidating the Blessed One's teachings in detail. And the Venerable Kamaka has explained, taught, proclaimed, established, disclosed, analyzed, and elucidated the Blessed One's teaching in detail." So what they're saying is, look, we didn't do this to give you a hard time, but, you know, we thought that you were capable of teaching us the Dhamma, and my goodness, you did. And that is what the Venerable Kamaka said. And elated, the elder bhikkhus delighted in the Venerable Kamaka's statement. And while this discourse was being spoken, the minds of 60 elder monks, and also of Venerable Kamaka, were liberated. With no clinging, they became arahats themselves. These are one of those stories, those sutras, when it was first said, it was such a powerful deep sutta, the people involved all became enlightened. That's why I like teaching it here. Because, did you understand it? Any luck today? Complicated. That's easy. Oh, this is just the way that people would speak in the time of the Buddha. You notice this so often that when, you know, we'd say one word in English, they would say many, many, many words. And sometimes I've, you know, looked at even old English, they would do pretty much the same. You know, they would say he was vexed, annoyed, troubled. Instead of just saying he was pissed off, they would have all these other names. So, you know, sometimes in Pali, if you can use three words instead of one, always use six. And that's usually the way. It does have the advantage of you use so many words that, you know, the meaning becomes quite clear. So it just gets the meaning from so many different angles. It pinpoints, like triangulates the meaning from three words. So it makes it far harder to be misinterpreted when it's three or four words for it. I know this is a nice part of it. So even I know there's no one in here. I've been a Buddhist for years. I know there's no soul in there. But still, you know, you maybe with your daughter, say, I'm fed up with you. There's still the idea of an I, a perception. When it says a conceit, it means a thought of I am. Exactly. That's why somebody was talking to me recently. They had just come from a retreat in the tradition of Ramana Maharshi. And that was one of the traditions which he established of having the thought, who am I, who am I, who am I? And taking that right down as far as you can go. But when I saw that one of the differences between that path and the Buddhist path, and when you say, who am I, is actually assuming you are something. It's just finding out what this something is. Instead of actually even doubting the very thought, I am. Exactly, yeah. So you keep on going. You know you are. You don't even doubt that perception. But you're just trying to find, you know, a place to link it to. And here the Buddha is saying, no. Look at this I am in terms of these five khandhas. And, you know, there's nothing outside these five khandhas. This is another point. I never actually stressed this point when I went through it here, where it says, do you think this I am apart from any of these khandhas? Because, you know, there are some traditions which says, oh yeah, there is an I am, a self, but it's not contained in the five khandhas. There is something apart from the five khandhas, and that's what you really are. Yeah, we admit, you know, you're not form, you're not perception, you're not not feelings, you're not perception, you're not volitional formations, you're not any of the consciousnesses, but you are something else. That's what you really are. And this is one place it mentions specifically. You're not, he says, and I'm not this, nor am I apart from this. So this is one of the suttas where it's very clear that to think this like an original mind apart from the five khandhas is obviously not in accordance with the teachings here. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah, it means you're not anything. No, it doesn't mean I am the nothing. It means you aren't.
Yes, you aren't.
Yeah. Oh yeah, say if. That was the hypothetical. If you think you have this view, this belief, this religion, that you, yes, you're not part of the five khandhas, but you are something else apart from the five khandhas, then you start following that hypothesis, What could you be? Whatever it is you are, you cannot be conscious. Whatever it is you are. Yeah. Yeah, you are. Yeah, but you are conscious in the heavenly realm, and you have feelings, you have perceptions. So, okay, so this is, you still have some form of five khandhas in the heavenly realm. So you're just swapping one five khandhas for another form of five khandhas. In the hell realm, yeah. So you still have the five khandhas. But, you know, we're talking here about, you know, if there was something outside of all of this, outside of the five khandhas, then what could it possibly be like? It's not conscious, so it's nothing. Exactly, not, because the five khandhas are just gone, finished. They have stopped. Yeah. Okay, now if you want to have even a better simile for this to overcome confusion, it is the simile in the Agarwatthagota Sutta. It's the best simile for what happens. It was the simile of the flame. You've heard me say this before, but I'll bring it up again now. A flame, say of a candle, depends on three things. On the wick, on the wax, and the heat. Those are the three causes. When they're there, there is the flame. When one of those causes is taken away, such as there's no more wax, or the wick is all burnt out, or the heat is blown away, then the flame is extinguished. So where does the flame go? It doesn't go anywhere, it's just gone out. You say it's gone out, but it means it's extinguished. He said that's the same as this thing called a human being. No, five candles, you may say. When they come together, there is a human being. When one of them goes out, the other ones go out too. And it means there's no more thing called a human being. No more I am. So you were just a flame. Right, who was it? Who was that singer? Elton John. You are just a flame in the wind. And now you're enlightened. I don't think that's what he meant. Anyway. Yes, another question over here first, yeah? It is. What it means, the arising and passing away, you know, these aren't permanent. These aren't existing all the time. They come because of causes. And when those causes disappear, the thing disappears. Like the simile of the flame. So, you know, you look at the thing called consciousness. Are you really a person listening to me now? And, you know, you may have the residual thought, conceit, you know, that, yeah, I'm listening to you. When you analyze it and look at it deeply, you know, this listening is just a phenomena. It comes because there's a sound, and then when there's a sound, the hearing turns on. And sometimes there's no sound there at all, there's no hearing at all. Now, you can't be the person hearing. After a while, you look at this again and again and again, and you realize that even hearing, you know, has its causes, it arises, it passes away. There's no one doing the hearing. And even this thing we call mind, we think is the one behind everything. Mind arises, mind passes away. And if you think that was you, then, you know, you're only here half the time. Even probably less for some of you. Sorry, I didn't mean that. So it couldn't count me you. Okay, Eddie, go on. Eddie first. I agree with you. Thank you very much. Next question. Sorry, Eddie. Yeah. Oh, it's nothing about.
Oh, there's nothing about healing. Yeah, go, okay, go on.
Yep. It was Chunda, Mahamogalana.
Yeah.
No, because. Yeah, but the point of the sutta was, yeah, it was not about healing his body, because his body wasn't his anyway. Who cares about things which aren't yours? Where he's really going there is this last lingering thing stopping him being fully enlightened.
Yeah.
This is this I am. So his being sick was just, I think, is not really an important part of the sutta. What's really important part of the sutta was, yeah, his lingering delusion of an I am there, knowing that these things weren't really there. If he was like an anagam, which it says here, this is a non-returner, his sickness, he would have no craving, no ill will. That's part of the fourth and fifth fetters. So he basically wouldn't mind being sick. He would just, things arising, passing away, that's all. But still, he wouldn't be fully enlightened. Yeah? Now this is actually, this was actually, okay, we're going here to another little point. This was a point of argument between the emerging Mahayana and the Theravada for a long time. And it was actually, it was Nagarjuna who started the Majjhimaka. And that was on one of the suttas, again in the Sanyutta Nikaya, in the Nidana Sanyutta. And this was I've read this out before, it's a beautiful sutta. And the Buddha said, you can't say there's nothing, because an arising is seen. And you cannot say there is something, because a passing away is seen. And he was saying, the idea of there's nothing there at all is totally contrary to the human experience. We see things coming into existence. We can't see there really is something, because as soon as it arises, it passes away again. And so the Buddha said, I teach by the middle way between absolute emptiness and something. And he said, that was a very beautiful sutta. And that particular sutta, not that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. He said, no, not the form is something. No, the in-between there. And that became Nagarjuna's attempt to actually to reconcile these two diverse opinions and go much closer to how the Buddha taught. Not there's nothing, not there's something. Is there? Is there? There is not. If there's an underlying consciousness, what does it underlie? What is it? What part of the khandhas is it in? When the Buddha, if you look at this particular Sanyutta, the Buddha says very clearly, so when we talk about that fifth aggregate of vijnana consciousness, And he says, our consciousness, whether near or far, you know, past, present and future, refined or gross, sort of cosmic underlying all consciousnesses, all of them, everything, is not me, it's not mine, not a self. It's all important, impermanent, it's all suffering, all consciousnesses. And this is why the Buddha was so precise and just knew all the loopholes and closed every one of them. So there cannot be an underlying consciousness which is us. An underlying permanent thing which is always there underneath our radar, and if we can only get deep enough meditation, powerful mindfulness, we'll see the underlying thing which is always there, our essential God nature, soul, original mind, or whatever you wish to call it. The Buddha said, no way. Go on. Movement. Exactly the same as you see your consciousness this moment making another consciousness the next moment. Because the question you just asked, you can see that question creating new thoughts, new ideas, new speeches coming in a second or two's time. You can see it as cause and effect, the process. You can notice everything, there's nothing there. It's a cause and effect process. There's no thing going from one place to another. All there is one thing causing and another effect happening afterwards. A good example of that is the law of gravity. The moon moves and the tides move. The sea moves. Now, all the tides, that's the effect of the gravitational force from our moon. That's basic science. But what goes across if the moon moves? What goes across? Is there something transferring that information, the postman? And for years, centuries almost, people have been looking for that, and there is nothing. And I've been arguing this, you know, with physicists for a long time. You're missing the point. Always having to think of a stream, something going across all the time, instead of a course, and then an effect, and then another, that affects the course, another effect, but nothing actually going across. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it is a no string at all. It is that you have a memory. There's a memory. You can remember your past lives, where you were before. But that is not stored anywhere in your body. Not even stored in your mind. It is an action at a distance process. So without anything going across. The other simile is the simile of a mango. You eat a mango today. Lynn always gets really delicious mangoes. I hope you save the seeds. And you plant them in the garden. I don't know how many years it takes for a mango to grow. And then maybe 5-6 years later on, we get a new mango tree and I eat that new mango. What went across from the first mango to the new mango? Is there like the soul of the mango? Or underlying mango-ness? Yeah, but there's nothing solid there at all. Every scientist knows that not even the DNA is the same. And the molecules continually die and they feed off each other. And so you can actually see the cause and you can see the links from that first mango, which I ate this morning, to the mango I hope I'll be eating 5 or 6 years' time. And I can see where the one comes from. But there's nothing gone across. There's no underlying thread. There's no underlying mango essence. It goes from one to the other. No even life force energy.
Yeah. You can see the energy right now, which you look at life force energy, is mostly desire, wanting. That is the force which drives you along, if you want to look at it that way. But you look at it much closer. And when you stop wanting things, when you stop wanting things, Eddie, then you still and you disappear. Yeah. Of course, the action is very easy, just like everybody can see their past lives. Even now, you don't have to be in line to see your past lives. And you can do that because this second thing called memory is not stored anywhere. You can access it. Yeah, go on, yeah. Yes. Of course. No, there can be. Some of his past. Some of the Buddha's past lives were in previous eons before the Big Bang. There wasn't even any. How on earth can you do that? Everything just exploded, nothing left. And some of those, how can that happen? And the only reason why is when you understand how memory works, especially the memory of previous lives. The action at a distance. You know, that's something which I hope you remember from your high school. Now that is real. That is a phenomena which we can know in our external world. And that gives you the key, you know, how especially memory can go from previous lives. Nothing is stored. Get that out of your head, that you have to have a storage place from now, or from when that event happened, it's stored somewhere, and then you can access it. It's not stored anywhere. You know, it's literally almost like going back into time. You don't have to sort of see, imagine like you have a time box. And to go back to sort of, you know, 200 years ago, you don't have to go back day by day, second by second. It means you're here now, and immediately you're somewhere else afterwards. Another similar event, which many people have experienced, you may have like a brother or a friend dies in KL. And they can appear here in Perth immediately. How on earth do they travel? Do they actually just fly through the air? Do they have to, from Malaysia, they have to pass over Singapore and, you know, over the Indian Ocean and then just, you know, over Exmouth and Geraldton and Shark Bay before, the other way around, before they get to Perth? Or is it they disappear in one place and they appear in another place without going through the spaces in between? And that's happened. Speed of light is only, people actually say the speed of light is a constant, but this goes into another thing. It's not a constant, it's been proved to change. It's a dogma. And it's only a theory, you can't go faster than the speed of light. So what if you did go faster than the speed of light? In fact, you know, they've got theoretical particles, tachyons. They're supposed to go faster than the speed of light. And it's a great little thing just to bend your mind. If a something faster than the speed of light hit you, it would hit you first and you'd see it coming later. Sorry, where you go? Yeah? This is. Yeah. Well, if you. This is a whole. This is what the whole point of the Buddha's teachings, to say there is nothing. It might seem there's something there, but when you see what that is and see it arising and passing away, seeing it totally disappearing. In meditations, it's very obvious. There is nothing. That's the whole point of seeing the Dhamma. And again, you don't get that by reading books. The books make it very clear that what it's supposed to be, but to be able to really understand that, it's not from reading books,
It's actually from the deep meditations and the insights, but you can't get the insights without reading the books. You need both of those together. So this is why we give the sutta class, to challenge you, and then to get you ready to come on a few retreats, and then we'll soon get that idea out of your head. Jhana, yeah. But it... This is the jhana states, because in the jhana states, I said this yesterday or Friday night, yesterday afternoon, in the jhana states, things vanish. So, you got things like your memory. You got things like your will. How can you know what those things are? This simile you've heard so many times, but it's the best one to explain the answer to the question. A tadpole born in the water, lived in the water, cannot understand what water is. Doesn't matter how many books on water the little tadpole reads. Doesn't matter if it goes to chemistry classes in university and Abhidharma classes to try and find out what water is. A tadpole can't understand water no more than a fish can understand water. Born in it, lived in it, all around, always there. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is a tadpole one day becomes a frog. And a frog one day jumps out of the water onto dry land. And the first time a little tadpole becomes a frog and jumps onto dry land, that blows her mind. They never experienced anything like this at all in its life so far. Something which has always been there is now missing. For the tadpole, or now the frog, that's called water. Now, a frog can understand what water is, once it's gone. That's what the meaning of jhanas are. There's so many things disappear in the jhanas. And because they're gone, like, you know, your body in the five senses, only now can you really understand what the body is and the five senses are. Your will vanishes in jhana. Only now can you understand what this will is. And your consciousness starts to vanish. Now you can understand what this consciousness is. Only when it's gone. How can a fish ever understand water? That's the reason why we have the jhanas. But unfortunately though, it's so hard to get jhanas. You know why? Because you have no wisdom. And we can't have wisdom without the jhanas. This is, you know, the difficulty of like practice. Nati jhana upanyasa panya nati ajayato. There's no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. So this is where, you know, you get a little bit more insight and wisdom. And that makes you let go a little bit more. A bit more wisdom, a bit more letting go. The two of these things work together. More understanding, more letting go. You can understand when you realize there's no will there, it's easy to let go. When you realize there's no consciousness there at all, there's no body there, it's easy to let go. The more you realize there's nothing there, the more you realize these things aren't the self, what am I worried about? Bye-bye, you can go. So, yes. Oh, can we have the microphone? Okay, is mind consciousness or consciousness part of the mind? There are six consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind consciousness. And once you've, through experience, understand what these are, why is it that people think or assume that seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and touching have something in common? And the reason is that every time you see something, then you know you've seen it. Every time you feel a sensation in the body, you know you felt that sensation in the body. Every time you have a thought, you know you had that thought. What is happening here is as soon as you have any one of these sense consciousnesses, mind consciousness follows afterwards. And that gives it the sense of sameness. What it really is, you see, you're now knowing consciousness. And I hear, knowing consciousness comes afterwards. And because they come so close together, we have the illusion that seeing and hearing are basically the same. It's not.
You see, and then you know you see. You hear, and then you know you hear. You know, and then you know you knew. And that was just an obvious mistake of philosophers like Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. No, I think, therefore, I was. Put the time in it. This idea of self-consciousness. I know that I know. You don't know that you know. I know that I knew. The mind takes on the previous object and knows it in you. When you see this whole procession of consciousnesses, now I made a point there, maybe you didn't sort of, you thought I had some speech impediment, but it wasn't a speech impediment, I said consciousnesses on purpose, because when we call it consciousness, there's six different types of consciousnesses. The mind is just one of the six. It is the dominant one, because that's how we understand this world, through that mind consciousness, which knows what we just saw. But when we're seeing, if you can look at this very carefully, when you see, you don't know you see. When you are seeing, you don't know you are seeing. You know just afterwards. So you see the different consciousnesses arising one after the other. When one arises, the other one disappears. And then once you see that, only then can you ask the question, which one is me? Because mind consciousness is not always there. But where have I gone? Very good. Yeah, but up and down and then it disappears. Okay. Very good. Okay. Yes, that's good enough. Yes, the microphone is now extension.
John, I was just wondering, you were talking about memory, the second type of memory being action from a distance.
Oh, yeah.
So I just had a couple of questions about that.
Yes.
One is the action that you're referring to, mindfulness in the past. That's the first question. And the second question is, if it is a moment of mindfulness in the past, then does that mean that all the times in your past life that you weren't very mindful, that you're not going to remember those?
That's an interesting question. Probably not. Because even if you are mindful, the mindfulness of an action or an event now is what imprints it on your brain. It's that first type of memory stuff. But this is another type of memory, which is nothing to do with your brain. It's not the Chinese whispers type of memory. So I would think even if you weren't mindful, that you'd be able to recall it. Yeah, the action in the distance, yeah, you'd still be able to recall it. Yes, that I think one of the problems is just the different ways that we imagine space and time. I love messing around with these concepts, because when I was in Penang, you know, people were, you know, talking because they're heavily influenced by Islam and Christianity. There was a Buddhist idea, you know, the origin of this world, of this universe. And what they're really talking about is the origin of time. And you always have the problem, this is just basic sort of stuff. If there was a cause for this universe, you know, a first cause of God, if everything has a cause, then what caused God? And what was the cause of God? It just keeps going backwards and backwards. And there's never an answer which is satisfying. So, you know, where did this world come from? And the answer, you know, is very much how I was taught to understand this universe in which we live in. This universe in which we live in, which you can see a small part when you look into the night sky, it has a fixed volume. There's only a certain amount of volume in space. It's roughly, you know, pi, what is it, 4/3 pi, 14 billion light years cubed. You know, that's the volume of the universe, basically. But it's got a fixed volume, but it hasn't got a beginning or an end in space. There's no edge. There's no barbed wire fence saying, end of the universe, you can't go any further. Or like I see Singapore, they have these barbed wire fences with pictures of, if you go further, you'll get shot. Or a wall, or an edge where you fall off into oblivion. There's no edge to the universe, yet it's a fixed volume. There's no beginning and end of the universe. So can we adapt that truth into time? No beginning or end of time, but just a fixed duration. And if you want to get your head around that, the simile which I was taught at school was of the ant walking around the soccer ball. And the ant walks around the soccer ball, and after a few circuits around, maybe a thousand circuits, he knows every inch of that soccer ball. There's no part of that soccer ball it hasn't been through before. And it realizes the soccer ball has got a fixed area, but it's got no boundary to it. No edge, no beginning or end of the soccer ball. Now, if you can take that idea of an ant, a fixed area with no edges, then you can understand this universe. A fixed volume, a fixed amount of space, but no edge, no beginning or an end of space. And then you can take it to time. A fixed amount of time, but no edge to it, no beginning, no end, but still only a certain duration. Now, you can understand how to answer, where did time begin? It's a stupid question. It's like asking, where did this universe begin? Where's its edges? It has no edges. But still, it's finite. A lot of the problems come because just our conceptual framework needs to be expanded. You know, people believe this earth was flat many years ago. Actually, not that long ago. Now we're so sophisticated. We all know this earth isn't flat, it's round, it's a ball, we can see it from outer space. But people still think that space is flat. And they think that time is flat too. It has to have a beginning. It has to have an end. Maybe not. There's the answer to the beginning of time. Hee hee hee. Okay, come on, Wayne.
You talk about a fixed volume, but didn't Lord Buddha talk about expanding and contracting the universe?
The Buddha expanding and contracting, yes, that's actually in there. Vivata and Sangvata, yes. Universe. Periods of expansion and contraction, or you could say evolving and devolving. That's, you know, usually the accurate meaning of that word. And what does it actually mean, evolving, devolving? It's not just even evolving in like space. It means like growing, 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 and then just fading away and just vanishing again. It doesn't mean like expanding and contracting. It just means growing, 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 and then decaying, passing away like everything else. Just like I've been evolving for years, but I'm now in my decaying stage. Oh, can you get the microphone so I can hear?
So what's the implication of that description of time for the question about what the distant action is for the second type of memory?
Yeah. It's an example of that when you change your perceptual framework, then you get the answers which, you know, were not able to be obtained because you had to change your perceptions first, the way of looking at things. And looking at even like time as being like something you have to travel through from second to second to second to second to second to second. You know, like a continual movement rather than jumping in time. Of course, your physical body can't jump into time, but your mind can. It does it all the time. It does it always backwards. You remember times. You know, can you remember, say, yesterday, and I sent you an email about that little beautiful advertisement. Do you remember that? Now, when did that happen? That happened about 12 hours ago. And you remembered it in a second. It didn't take you 12 hours to go back to that memory. You jumped. So, can we have this beautiful jump back into time? And this is the thing that if you, and I can't tell anybody about memories of past lives, but I always, you know, say my loophole, memories of early events in this life, you know, that story which I put in my book about remembering when I was a baby. And that was, you were back in there. You were re-experiencing that event. So, you know, I could actually move around and check things out. Just like I can check things out now. Oh, what's this? There's a clock here. What's this piece of paper? That's what I could do. It wasn't really time travel. It was just, you know, the memory which you get through meditation. And if you ask that of people in hypnosis, when they get past life memories, they can move around. They can ask questions. They can look around, find out what, you know, who they were with. Whether it was a sunny day or whether it was raining when they had this previous life. Now that is really fascinating when you can do that. That's the experience of it. How can you do that? You know, it's a totally different being, totally different time. So this is actually where it is. Action of the distance. Basically the distance is the problem. There is no distance, that's just perception. You know, that London to Perth is just so many miles. It's not. That's why, you know, a ghost or astral travel, you can go back there immediately. This mind stuff is really weird. But that's, you know, really good stuff to bend your mind. Okay. Nice, interesting stuff for you to think about. But the main point of it is the I Am, which is a wonderful little teaching. So, thank you for listening. I hope it was enjoyable. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And I can go back to monastery.